Hi, I'm Colleen Conahan, and this is Recognize. Act like you know. This time last year, we did the 135 Challenge, profiling 135 baller women in sports who simply do not receive the coverage they deserve from sports media. To cap that all off, I ran a 135-mile race across Death Valley in the face-melting heat of July, a little thing called Badwater. Running Badwater was incredible. It challenged me mentally, physically, and emotionally, and chafed me in places I never dreamed possible. Today, July 11th, 2022, 100 new badass runners will take off on their own Badwater adventure. And I am so pumped for them as they run their own ultramarathons, earn their own blisters, and smash their own limits. If you're curious what Badwater was like, today we're dropping my exit interview with Clay Skipper, where I'll recap the highs, the lows, the yelling, the pooping, and the long, slow grind across the desert. But this is your fair warning, because Recognize is coming back hard, like after a 4-minute micro nap 112 miles into the race. This fall, we'll be releasing full-length episodes exploring coverage of women's sports, what's wrong, how you can help fix it, why it matters, and giving you the real story about these amazing athletes. For now, put on your hoodie and crank up that space heater. But stay tuned for the real deal. We can't wait to share this with you.
All right. Well, hi, Colleen. Welcome to your own podcast.
Wow. Thanks, Clay. It's kind of like a revelation to be here, honestly.
So Badwater was the 21st of July, right?
It started the 19th, but it ended on the 21st. So you're not wrong.
Yes, which is insane because when I looked you up on there and, you know, they have like the time and the mile and then they have date. And I'm like, oh, my God, that right there says it all. Like the fact that there are 3 days where it says date checked into like the checkpoint, that was eye opening.
Yeah. And it's funny because I feel like a lot of people then think, oh, you probably just got a nice night of sleep or what have you. But no, you're to the extent you possibly can on your feet and moving the whole time, right? It's not like there's a staged area. Okay, tonight we're landing here and we pull our sleeping bag out or whatever it is. No, it's just like you're continuously moving forward. It's tough for sure.
Well, we'll get into some of the specifics because I am curious about that, about pacing and everything like that. But before we do, we're recording this on August 11th. So that's what, like 20 days almost. Are you still in pain? Have you gotten to the point where you are no longer in pain? What is your pain like these days?
So I'm not in pain. I walked away so fortunately injury free. I felt like I was expecting, oh, my metatarsal would be sore or tender or some nagging fatigue injury that you just expect. Some of the 100-milers that I've done, I've walked away with tendinitis that I continued to run through, or, you know, like you just have some soreness that continues. But while I'm not in pain, I will tell you that I do not have any like get up and go. And I've talked to one of the people who was on my team, my support crew. I was like, Ricky, do you think like, is this a problem that I still feel slow? And he's like, no, just be patient with your body. Just keep clicking off miles. If they're slower, they're slower. If your legs feel heavy, your legs feel heavy. As long as you're not, you know, incurring any new injuries, you can just keep pressing on and just give yourself a break for not being as fast as you were before running 135 miles.
Yeah, seriously. So 135 miles. So how many ultras have you done and 100 milers if those are different numbers?
Yeah, so I've done 300 milers, which is the minimum requirement to apply for Badwater is 3. So I was actually surprised that that was enough for me to get in. I have done, I believe, 6 50 milers. I've done 100K and I've done a whole bunch of marathons. Last year when the Boston Marathon got canceled, I did a double marathon by myself. As training for Badwater, I did a 70 miler by myself. So definitely a lot of miles under my belt, some of them in race form and other ones just grinding it out as kind of a solo performance, a solo runner, which is a totally different head game, of course.
Yeah. And so is the marathon like your gateway into this? Is that how you got in? Is that how people get into ultras? Because I'm always curious how people actually get into ultras.
100%. And that's why I've come to talk to you today, Clay, because after your marathon, I'm just sucking you right into this vortex. But yeah, no, I started running marathons and a friend of mine had met somebody at a tailgate and was just like, you need to talk to my friend Mossy, because Mossy had run ultra marathons and I loved running even my first marathon, which was a disaster. I came back in the second. I mean, it was so bad. But the second one, I came back and I was like, I love this. I dropped my time by 40 minutes. And I was like, look at me. I'm going to be an Olympian, which I'm not. But nonetheless, I felt like it unlocked so many possibilities. And I just loved the training process. So yeah, I talked to this guy, Masi, who I'm still very close with. And I was like, I'm thinking about dipping my toe in. And around here in DC, in Western Maryland, there is the JFK 50 miler, which is known as kind of the first American ultra marathon. It started because Teddy Roosevelt had said that any American military troop should be able to move on foot with gear 50 miles in a day.
Wow.
And so this became this kind of tradition. But that was the first ultra marathon that I did. I jumped right into a 50 miler. Loved that. I think a lot of people see 50 miles as close to double a marathon distance and think like, there's no way I could possibly do that. But it's a totally different game. If you like endurance, if you like pushing yourself to the point where you have to dig deep and get beyond just the physical, you really have to tap into your mind and strategy. If that's something that you enjoy, then ultra marathons, I think, are a very logical next step. And they're shockingly accessible.
Well, interesting. Well, I'm now all right, I'll do it.
All right, great. You're in.
Okay. Okay, so Badwater, so you mentioned there you have to apply for it. Okay, so I didn't even know this. So how do you get into the Badwater? How many people get in? I'm curious about all that.
The goal for the race is for people to be able to actually successfully do it. And so it's a pretty restrictive application process. It feels a lot like you're going to college. There's like essay questions. You have to have done at least 300 milers. There are questions about like your motivation for doing it, what you bring to the ultra community and the Badwater community and how you embody the Badwater spirit. Yeah. And ultimately there's kind of a review board that selects 100 people every year. I don't know what the number of applicants are, but I know that it is a highly coveted race. It was certainly on my bucket list. The reason that it's selective, of course, is that thus far, zero people have died during Badwater, and they want to keep it that way, right?
Yeah.
Because it's known as the toughest foot race in the world, really. Mm. Having just amateurs or people who aren't serious about the sport try to do it would be, you know, a fool's errand for sure.
Because first of all, tell people where you're going. You're going through Death Valley.
Yeah, so Badwater is in Death Valley. It's basically across the entire expanse of Death Valley. So it starts at Badwater Basin, which is the lowest point in North America. It's 282 feet below sea level. It's the hottest temperature ever recorded on Earth. And the reason that Death Valley stays so hot is it's kind of like a bowl, right? So the hot air gets trapped and just kind of swirls around. There's no way for it to exit. So it just kind of bakes constantly. And yeah, so Badwater Basin is at the lowest point there. And then you wind up having to climb your way out. So you run, there's kind of rolling hills. And then throughout the course of Badwater, there are actually three separate mountain climbs. And there's a 15-mile stretch where you're climbing 5,000 feet. And it's just brutal. And then you wind up losing almost all of it. And then you do another mountain climb. Yeah, it's just absolutely devastating to know, like, I did all that work and now it's just gone. It's just gone. And then you do another series of switchbacks. And then the last 13 miles, right? So 122 to 135 are just vert. Like you are just climbing Mount Whitney. You are on no gas, just fumes, and just kind of gutting and gritting it out. It's really tough. Now, if the temperature doesn't get you, the hills will get you because it's so hot. The sleep deprivation aspect is incredibly challenging. The hits just keep coming and you just got to figure it out. There's so much. And I think that's consistent across most ultra marathons. So much of it is actually just mental troubleshooting, right? You've got this base, this foundation of the amount of training that you've done, but you're going to have to figure out how to solve problems, whether it's a cramp that you have or whether it's that your nutrition isn't going the way that you want it to. There's just so much of it that is knowing and understanding your body and figuring things out on the fly.
How many people finished this year? Do you know?
Actually, only 84 started this year, and the number of finishers was in the 60s. It's wild. Consistently, like an 80% completion rate, which is much higher than most people would think because it draws such serious runners who know what they're going into and what they're going up against.
Yeah. And what did you say, if I might ask, for what your motivation was on that essay question?
I'm so interested in my limits. And I think it's pretty audacious when people set out to do something where they know they might fail. I've crewed for Badwater two times. I crewed my friend Masi, who I brought up earlier, who's really how I got into ultra running. And I was on his support crew 1 year when he DNF'd, or that which stands for did not finish.
Yeah.
And I was on his crew the next year when he came back with a vengeance and succeeded. Now, the time that he DNF'd, he had a time goal in mind. He had run it two times previously, and he really wanted to beat 30 hours. But, you know, I had seen both the good, bad, and the ugly of a Badwater crossing. And I was really curious to see if I had what it took. Mossy kind of challenged me, as did the other members of my crew. They were like, you're next.
Huh.
And I took that challenge very seriously and applied in 2020 and got in. And then I did the entire training cycle 10 days before the race. They canceled it because of COVID. It was devastating.
Oh,
just
my God.
A gut punch. Yeah,
Jesus.
Brutal.
Okay, so you mentioned the training cycle. So let's get into that. Because in some ways, this is going to sound crazy, but to me, it seems like the mileage might actually be the easiest thing to train for, right? Because it's just math. It's just if you run X amount of miles and you figure it out, then you're good.
You nailed it.
But the other stuff, heat training, sleep deprivation, hydration, that, the mental focus it takes, that all seems like wildly difficult to train for. So walk me through the training program. How does it work? What does it look like? How do you prepare for all those different aspects of it?
So, I mean, it starts really, I mean, the race being in mid to late July, you start training as soon as you hear that you've been accepted, which is in February. And it's like, all right, let's do it. Now, presumably you've been doing some amount of training, or I certainly
not starting
have,
on the
know.
couch to 5K
exactly.
program.
This is, this is not a couch to 5K situation. So started in earnest in February, and you just kind of ramp up your mileage. It's much more about the number of miles per week that you're running, as opposed to a marathon where it's like, I have a long run of 20 miles this week, and that's the peak, blah, blah, blah. But for Badwater, as it is with many ultra marathons, it's a volume training program. And so I was, you know, I probably started at somewhere in the neighborhood of like 60, 65 miles a week. You know, it's like 8 miles a day with maybe a rest day and a long run in there. And you build up to, you know, for the majority of my training cycle, I was doing between 85 and 100 miles a week, which is a lot. Like, that is a huge time suck. So you're running double digits on average every single day. But, you know, while you're doing that, my approach was like, all right, I woke up this morning at some godforsaken hour before the sun rises. How am I feeling? And so what I would then try to do is calibrate how many miles can I actually run based on how my body feels, both because it's either sleepy tired or my muscles are tired, and just kind of continuing to check in on any like, oh, I have heel pain, that kind of a thing. But it was really just kind of maximizing the number of miles and trying to get to some large number at the end of the week of 85 to 100 miles. The biggest training run that I did was a 70 miler that I did in late May or early June. And a lot of that was testing my mental game at that point. I knew that I had the physical fitness, that if I had a race, like if I had a 100 miler, I know I could have done it. But I wanted to see, all right, 70 miles by yourself, go. See how this goes. Test out your nutrition strategy and your hydration strategy on the fly. Those are things, and I'm sure you've heard this in your marathon training, you never want to try something for the first time on a race or event day. So you need to work out these things, and you're going to eat some uncomfortable things. In ultramarathons, like one of the things that works great for my body and I love is pickles and pickle juice. Mm-hmm. But for some people, that's like, not in a million years, will turn my stomach, right? But I kind of have a trash gut. So I'm like, cool, I'll eat this Pop-Tart and drink this pickle juice and keep it moving, right? And like,
you should just dunk the Pop-Tart right in the pickle juice. Get it nice and soggy. I can imagine that's a great combo of flavors, the brininess with the sugary. Yeah, that
don't tempt
awesome.
Me with a good time. I'm in. And so, yeah, it's a lot of that kind of experimentation that you wind up doing along the way and seeing what works, right? For example, during this training cycle, I drank a lot of Pedialyte and I was like, my body really likes Pedialyte, right? Like it's over other sports hydration solutions. That was a thing that worked great for me. Now, about 5 weeks before the race, you're not going to get that much more fit. So your mileage, you just got to keep some level of maintenance. You don't want to overtrain. So you want to go into the race fresh. You definitely don't want to go in with any injuries. And those 5 weeks, what you focus on is heat training. And this, I think, it's the most challenging aspect, both of Badwater and of the training. And so last year when gyms were closed, what I would do, because saunas were not available to me, is I would put on 6 layers of sweats.
Oh, God.
And I would sit in my bathroom with a space heater on and drink hot tea. Or I would sit in my hot parked car in Washington, D.C. with the windows up with the same 6 layers of sweats on and just sit there for an hour and just sweat my brains out. But this element of heat training, it does 2 things, which are kind of mind-blowing. Biophysically, it actually brings your veins closer to your skin so that they cool off more quickly. And the other thing that it does is your body learns to process fluids more quickly. And so you sweat much more quickly. Like as soon as you're hot, your body's just like, we're doing this. And there you are sweating. So great for when you're running Badwater. Not so great when you're trying to be a civilized human at dinner with your friends. And you're just...
Especially in DC.
I mean, yeah, like you go to happy hour and you're just kind of drenched. But you know, these are the things we do for the sports that we love. This year, I was actually able to go into a sauna thanks to vaccines. And when I was in there, the first few days, you know, I would sit in the sauna.
Are you wearing
for
the 6 pairs of sweats?
No, this time I'm just like, I'm just a regular person.
Okay.
Sweating like the rest of us. But I will say that I outlasted every person. Right. And I wasn't even being competitive. I was just like, I got to be in here for an hour. And you see all these guys, they're just like cooking and then they're out of here. And the first few days that I did it this past training cycle, it was like 180 degrees and I was in there for an hour and I felt great. I was like, look at me, I'm like doing this. And then one day, the next day, I couldn't make it past 35 minutes. And I was wondering, I was like, what happened? Oh my God, have I taken a massive step back? So I like left the sauna, I like regrouped, I cooled off and I went back in there. I was like, we're getting to an hour. Like we got to get that number. And then I finally looked at the temperature gauge and it was 200. And I was like, that is why you can't last for an hour in here because you are a hot steamy mug of tea.
And so do you do it every day for those 5 weeks?
I didn't do that every day for 5 weeks, but every run that I went on was in multiple layers of sweats and stuff like that. And so you're really just trying to acclimate your body. And then something that I know a lot of my friends think is psychotic, but you know, I'm working from home and I would be in a small closed off room in my house and I would have a space heater on while I'm wearing sweats, like just working. You know, it was definitely over 90 degrees at my desk. The more that you can expose yourself to high temperatures and get yourself to just be constantly sweating, drinking, you know, I've never been more hydrated in my life. And that's really both from the mental game perspective and physically, the things that I believe prepared me the most to be successful in such an extreme climate condition.
Wow. And so what is the temperature in the actual race? What's the lowest it gets and the hottest it gets?
Yeah. So the start of the race was, and this was at 8 p.m. The start of the race was 111. And throughout the course of the next day, it got to 118. And so,
Jesus.
You know, like, yeah. So it's, I mean, it is hot and there is no reprieve. I will not forget that there was a period late in the second day. So I'm 85, 90 miles into this race and I'm so tired of wearing this ice bandana that goes around your neck and it keeps you cool, but I am chafing just so badly. And I was like, can I just take this off? And my crew chief, Ricky, goes, it's still 102. So no, at that point, I was just like, I don't even know what hot is anymore. Like what is 102? Interestingly, once you exit Death Valley and start climbing towards Mount Whitney. So that's basically like, let's call it mile 108, it drops to about 70 degrees, which is at that point, 40 degree swing. I was wearing a sweatshirt at a point because I was freezing.
And so did you feel like the heat training prepared you or was it still completely unbearable when you were actually running the race?
For the most part, I felt prepared. There is one section of this race called Panamint Valley, and it is from miles 68 to 73. The sun is just baking this one section and you're on a black road and the heat is just radiating up from the road and there's no cross breeze. And so this particular section I felt like was unbearable. And I took a video of myself at the start of it, not knowing, but I was just like, we're doing great. I have a buddy in with me who's pacing me and he's spraying me with, do you know, like the thing that you hook your garden hose up to and you'd like spray fertilizer on your crops. So it's basically that. And it's just filled with cold water. So he's like spraying me. He's like, it's Hurricane Harbor in here. Right. And I'm in like the greatest of moods at mile 68. And we fast forward 30 minutes. And I'm just like, I'm in such a dark place because it's just so hot. My legs have these little red swirls on them because they're just cooking. So I feel like that section was one where I'm not sure that you could have been prepared. I do know that Sally McCray, she actually won the race when she got out of that section and then up the next climb. My crew saw her and they were like, yo, she left here crying, like crying. Cause it's, I mean, it's just brutal. You're just cooking and you're so tired and you're so hot, but I do feel like there is some reprieve and you just have to push through, which is, I guess, ultimately what I did is I took a nap. And I don't have kids, but I imagine anybody who has a toddler knows how beneficial it is to take a 30-minute nap when you're cranky. And so that was really a huge game changer for me.
Wow. And so, yeah, I want to hear, A, how you train for the sleep deprivation, and then when do you take that nap? Are you moving the whole time? Are you running the whole time? Are you walking some of it? Like, how does that even work? What's the pacing like?
I don't really think there is much training for sleep deprivation. I'm sure there are ways to do it. I've been told, you know, like cut out caffeine before the race so that when you have it at the race, you're very responsive to it. And I found that to be helpful. But otherwise, you're just kind of going in blind. I went into it thinking initially, like, maybe I won't sleep. Masi, both times that I crewed him, did not really sleep. He took one nap the first year when he DNF'd. And the second year, he took zero naps. He just pressed on and just kept moving. And so that was kind of like where my headspace was at. But in kind of processing the fact that it's a night start, which is already so difficult to like, it's tough to start at night. I'm a morning person. The idea of starting something at 8 p.m. is really kind of like a mind fuck. I just kind of wanted to press through, but I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do it. And so we decided that after Panamint Valley that we would take a nap. And I was just racked out in the van, the support crew van that was with us. I was just laying in there with the AC blasting on me and just took a 30-minute nap and woke up and truly felt like a new person.
Wow.
And I did another 30-minute nap probably around 8 p.m. That was at mile like 93 or 95. It was at the point where I was basically drunk, right? Like, I mean, yeah. If you looked at me, you'd be like, yo, this person is on something. And so I just, you know, I took a 30-minute nap, woke up and was like refreshed and rejuvenated. And I took one more nap that was 4 minutes long, which seems impossible, but I just walked into the van and I was like, I just need to like lay for a second. And I closed my eyes and was out. And then 4 minutes later, my crew chief, Ricky, was like, all right, let's go. And I was like, I'm ready. Like, and it felt like,
wow.
Again, it was like night. It was literally like night and day. I think in terms of sleep deprivation, that's something that you could probably learn to do better is nap, or like integrate that into your, do some overnight runs just to see how your body reacts to running in the middle of the night and how short your naps can be to still be effective.
So how does the crew actually work? So there's a van with you. You've got a whole team. Sounds like you have some pacers. I assume they're helping with nutrition and hydration, but I'm curious how the whole crew situation goes down.
Yes. So every racer at Badwater is required to have a support crew. And you can have a minimum of 2 people, but up to 4 people. And so we had 4 in our crew. Typically, the way it works is you have one person who is your crew chief. This is the boss of all bosses. In my case, it was this guy, Ricky Haro. He is such a badass. He has done a solo self-supported crossing of Death Valley. What that means, wow. Clay, is that he re-engineered a shopping cart with brakes and made it streamlined and carried all his own supplies, his own ice, his own water, his own food, and any medical supplies he would need, and pushed himself from Badwater Basin up to Mount Whitney and Jesus. Did it literally by himself. Total beast. Wow. So anyway, this is the guy you want in charge yeah. of your health and well-being. So that's Ricky. And then I had 3 other people, Kaylee Demerjian, Jimmy Wilburn, and Brenna Bray. And all 3 of them were part of the support crew. So you have a van and it basically leapfrogs me every 2 miles, right? Drives up here, puts its flashers on. I run to it. They give me water. They give me whatever food, fuel, new gear change, whatever it is that I need in that moment. And then they move up ahead. And so it's just kind of this moving target that I'm constantly leapfrogging with. And after you get to mile 42, you're allowed to have pacers hop in with you. And so whether that's for motivation or to keep you on some specific pace, or really just to mule your water bottle, for example, or to spray you with cooling, that's a really big advantage, is to have somebody with you who's helping to drive you on. And so from mile 42 onward, I had a pacer with me. I think that if I were to do it again, I would have less of that, because typically I run by myself, right? Like my training is almost entirely by myself. And I feel like I'm able to go to a headspace and just push through. And even, you know, the ultra marathons that I've done, I love interacting with other runners and being a part of the experience. But I would say that the vast majority of those races, I'm running by myself and I'm able to kind of check in with my body a little bit more and know what's going on and also tap into some mental side of things that is really beneficial. And so if I were to do it again, which I'm not sure I would, but you know, if I were to do it again, I think I would spend more time by myself. But having said that, my crew was amazing. They did a great job of kind of restarting my engine. So let's say mile 90, when I am just dragging, right? I'm so slow. I'm so tired. I'm making excuses. My stomach's a little upset. And you just need someone, like, it's not even like they're coddling you, but you just need somebody who's like, hey, do you think you could run to that sign up there? And you're like, yeah, yeah, I think I could. It's literally that simple. They're just like, what about if we just run to the next reflecting thing? And you're like, I think I can commit to that. It's really just that small trigger. Instead of you having to ask the question, somebody else is asking it. And you also have that sense of accountability of like, I don't want to let this team down. They don't want to let me down. We're all in this together. It makes it feel much more like a team sport. And I grew up playing team sports and my first experience at Badwater was as a crew member. So yeah. I know how like gratifying it was for me to see my friend succeed. And I just feel like that good vibes and those good, like that good energy helps propel you along the way as well.
I can imagine. And you mentioned there in the Panamint Valley, am I saying that right?
Panamint.
You said you went to a dark place there.
Oh, God.
Describe even what is the like mental journey that you go on. Because even when you're talking about training and you're like, the farthest I run is 70 miles, I'm like, even that, like I would get to the starting line and be like, okay, so I've done 70. I need to do another 65. Nope, I can't do it.
Right.
I'd be like, and thereby, psychologically, I would be defeated already.
I wish I had a better answer. There's just an aspect of you that's like, you can do this. And sometimes it's as simple as like, you can do another mile, right? And, you know, I've heard Ryan Hall, he's one of the best American marathoners of all time. His quote is, run the mile you're in. If you can finish this mile, you can reevaluate how you feel in a mile from now. Or you can finish this section. That is a small goal. You can bite it off. You can chew it. You can swallow it and put it behind you. And at a certain point, I feel like in a marathon for me, it's when I hit mile 17 and now I'm counting down miles, right? I have 9 miles to go. I'm single digits and I'm counting down instead of counting up for something like this. It's like when you're at mile 90, it's over. You're doing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's
what's crazy
is like I still had 40 miles to go. You know what I mean? 45 miles to go. And I was like, oh, 90. I got this, right? There's just a point where you're like, I'm not stopping now. There's no way that I'm stopping. I'm just doing this. And I feel like everything that you do as part of training and everything you do as part of the race sets you up for greater success down the road. Because the first tough moment that we didn't even talk about this, the first 17 miles, Clay, we started in a weather pattern called a haboob, which I had never heard of. Right. Have you heard of it? Me neither.
No. Sounds terrible.
Exactly. And it was. So as we're driving in, there's this like hazy cloud hanging overhead. And Ricky's like, you might run into a haboob. And I was like, what's that? And he's like, have you seen The Mummy? Terrific. Like just what a girl always dreams of. But basically it was like a dust storm.
Jesus.
And we ran the first 17 miles into a headwind. It was as if you had resistance bands on you. It was intense. I mean, but I somehow was able to persevere through that. You're fresh, you're excited. Like you're going to get through that section. But over that first night at probably like mile 30 something, which should not be challenging for me, right? Like if you're having trouble at mile 30, you're going to have, this is going to be a long outing. But I was just feeling really groggy. And that was the first time that I was like, all right, how am I going to solve this? I drank some Coca-Cola. I had a bunch of candy. I then put in my headphones. I was literally just singing out loud to everyone in the desert who was no one. And finally, I like snapped out of it. You know, I was able to click back into being fully cognizant and feeling good. And I feel like it's little successes like that when you're like, that didn't beat me. So I got this next thing too. That's not going to beat me. This uphill section, I got you. I'm also just naturally overconfident and cocky. That kind of rash chip on my shoulder plays into my ability to succeed when things are objectively terrible.
Yeah. And do you have any like self-talk in that moment when you either in that section there at mile 30 or another time in the race where you had to like do a similar navigation of a mental hurdle?
Previously, like in other races, there's been just like a line from a song that has just been stuck in my head. But this one, there were two words. It was just find it, find it. So whatever it was, right? Like find your pace, find the thing that's going to get you out of this, find the mental motivation, whatever it was. The words that like came to me were find it. I said that to myself probably 400 times over the course of the race. And it wasn't like a mantra I repeated aloud to myself or some kind of self-empowerment thing. It was just like, this is the objective. You have work to do. You got to get there. And the only way to get there is to keep moving. Whatever you have to do, just find it. There's no excuses. No one else is going to do it for you. Just find the motivation, find the ability to get there.
Wow. I love that. I'm going to steal that. All right. Well, I think that is a perfect place to end. So yeah. Thank you for jumping on with me, explaining how to make my veins rise closer to the surface of my skin. That's one of the craziest things I've ever heard. And I've done a lot of interviews.
Yeah, it's bananas. Clay, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
No, this is great. I'm so grateful that I was able to do this interview, and I'm excited to run Badwater.
Yes, you're in. Can't wait. I can't wait for you to run. I'm going to crew you. I'm going to feed you
this
Pedialyte.
This is not a legal contract. This is not binding.
Yeah. Act like you heard. Keep your ear to the ground. We spread the word. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the stories. We've got so much more to share with you all coming this fall. Can't wait to see you then. Cover, 'cause we bout to blow. Full show, no BS, no BS. Got the party in the pocket. You can try your best, but it ain't no stopping.